Kim, in our last conversation, you described the essential ingredients for creating the conditions where young people can really learn and thrive: the physical environment, relationships, student agency, peer ecology, and leadership. You also talked about the importance of measuring what matters so that SEL doesn't stay invisible. That brings me to a body of work that I want to spend this conversation on: the Middle Years Development Instrument. What many people know as the MDI, which you developed to do exactly that, to make visible at a population level how children in their middle years are actually doing across those dimensions, and then to enable people to act on it. Before we get into what the MDI reveals, tell us briefly, what problem were you trying to solve when you set out to create it? What was missing from the data landscape in schools and communities?
Thank you so much, David, for the question. And I do have to say, the MDI has been part of my life for, oh God, I want to say at least 25 years from its how it actually got started. And really, I think of a phrase: what's not assessed is not addressed. And I know so much, at least in the US and in Canada as well, in British Columbia, where I was at the time when the MDI was developed, is that there was such a focus on achievement, of course, school achievement, reading, math, how kids were doing, but no information whatsoever about how children are doing. If you went and asked someone, how are the children doing? No one could give you the answer. Maybe there'd be some small surveys that did something more for older children. And so I realized that to really get the well-being and social emotional competencies and children's assets and the conversational landscape, that we needed to have some kind of assessment tool, some sort of measure to be able to measuring really what matters for children. And I do have to say, in some ways, in the landscape, when I was starting this, I actually did my sabbatical with Roger Weisberg in 2008. And it was that time that I was really talking with him about the idea of, you know, what really is going to get SEL sustainable is some sort of assessment. Because otherwise, people are going to think, yeah, it's nice to have, and we think the kids are doing better, but unless you really have some way to get at it, you won't. So it was really to try and surface more intentionally the conversation about children's well-being and their resilience and their assets. I think that to really bring up that conversation and how much people would believe in it that way. And just to talk about, I'll explain what the MDI is and what it's done. But the other thing that really was important was with the MDI, it's really a measure, not just for schools, but for communities. And the MDI was actually funded by the United Way in British Columbia, because the United Way was really focused on children in the middle childhood years, ages four, grades 4 to 7. And they said they wanted to have some sort of assessment to know how all the other organizations they support, like after school programs, community centers, can support that. So interestingly, it wasn't the university, it wasn't a research grant. It actually was the United Way that funded the development of the MDI.
It's interesting you're bringing up Roger Weisberg, because Roger really thought, and I would say understood, that assessment is an intervention in its own right. And what you assess and how you go about the assessment really impacts on how people think about the work that they're doing.
Yes, I totally agree. Roger was one of the big, besides you, one of the biggest champions of getting the MDI going because of the importance of assessment and because of the idea of surfacing that assessment in a way that is, I love the idea of thinking about intervention, but really thinking about using the data to share back with communities. And it was in using that phrase, using data as a flashlight and not as a hammer.
When I first learned from you about the MDI, I was so excited about it because you were able to do something that I had set out to try to do. But like you, I was dependent on who would enable me to do it. So that when in early 2001, after Bush was elected, it became very apparent that what we now know as No Child Left Behind was about to happen, I made a commitment to myself, and I also told people at AIR that I was going to try to realize that if I could, to spend 10 to 15 years trying to create conditions where schools and communities were collecting and using data on how people were doing socially, emotionally, ethically, and academically. But my first adopter was a good school system, Chicago, but they were not interested in anything outside of school, nor were they interested in the whole child. They were interested in the conditions for learning that are important, but what you were able to do, in part because you were working with the United Way, was to go beyond that, but in addition, with a focus that was on the whole child and not just on the learning aspects of the child.
It's so true. You bring up, and just I do have to say, so is David, we've had conversations. It's actually was your conditions for learning survey you did in Chicago that was an inspiration for me in figuring out how to report back the data, the MDI data. But really, if I think, I'm going to just tell you, often these, the way there was uptake. So now the MDI, there's hundreds of thousands of children in BC who have taken it. It's been translated into several languages, it's being used throughout the world. But the conditions were so interesting because number one, Clyde Hertzman, an MD epidemiologist, had started something called the EDI, the Early Development Instrument, which was adopted by the Ministry of Education in 2001 in British Columbia, where kindergarten teachers completed an assessment of children's social emotional competence and cognitive development and other dimensions. And so that had already gained traction. And what Clyde had done, which is brilliant, that when the data first came out, he visited every single school district in British Columbia, mind you, there's 60, to share their data with them. So when I came around with the MDI in Layton, there had been such a uptake of interest in data and interest in that. So I do have to say, so there was a United Way funding it. There was already such a interest in, from the EDI had built up such momentum, and the idea of then coming with something during the school years was really, people were very enthusiastic.
Part of this podcast series is really trying to enable people to learn how they can, in any moment, be generative and creative and do good. And part of that is knowing that in every environment, there are historical opportunities that function as affordances. And so in this case, the fact that the EDI was there already plowed a field for you. And I think part of what we have to do when we are social innovators, entrepreneur, social entrepreneurs, is to really figure out what are the characteristics of the space that we're operating in that create those affordances.
It's so true. And then I have to say, and then I'll get to explain the MDI so people have more ideas of what it is. But the thing that was so critical to me, having been a former classroom teacher, worked with students, worked in community quite a bit, is I realized, and again, trying to think of Seymour Saracen, he's always like in my mind, giving me little pieces of advice. And he was one of Roger Weisberg's mentors, is the idea that I believe that to create it, I had to involve all those people who would be using the data. So I didn't just, of course, I got my top researchers, colleagues to give feedback, what would be the dimensions we'd want to look at with children's social emotional competence. So we had a working group, but the working group who worked together for 2 years, sitting in rooms, identifying which would be the areas. It was university professors, it was educators, head of the teachers union. I do have to say that was an important part of our thing. It was also, besides the educators, it was community members. I had someone from United Way at the table, but people who ran after school programs, community health nurses. So everyone who would be involved and parents. And then when we developed it and piloted it, we of course went to the stu children. And we did lots of interviews with them, focus groups for them. So I felt, so when we finally finalized it after many pilots and conversations, it was really everyone had buy-in. Everyone saw that that they had contributed and they had a stake in it. So I feel that's another to me, the success of the MDI was taking that approach to really, and now mind you, it's long, it takes time, it could be, you need a lot of patience, and but I do feel that it led to such an uptake and interest that it wouldn't have happened if I didn't do that.
Stakeholders not only have a stake, but they need to see that their stake is there so that they have a stake in what the change is. That it's not just something that is being done to them, but being done with them. And I think you're very right. So now let's give people a picture of what the MDI is. And also let me add that because it's available for free, there'll be a link to it on the website as well so people can utilize it. The MDI measures optimism, self-esteem, happiness, empathy, pro-social behavior, self-regulation, perseverance, alongside connectedness to adults at home and in the community, and how children spend their time outside of school. That's a real important wide angle. Why that entire aperture?
Again, and I want to say we also measured because we had these health people on there. We also measure healthy eating, time going to bed, how many days a week do you have meals with a family member, all this other health and nutrition. And the reason we did that is again, so the MDI basically, it's a self-report measure of children's well-being and assets inside and outside of school, just simply stated. It is a measure that is self-report. So we align it with the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child so that every child has a right in what's happening to them. So we really use that self-report, but we had quite validated. We wanted it to be useful to people. If we think about a whole child education, and you think about every, I know it takes a village, that everyone had to see themselves in it. That if you are doing after school programs, actually, some of the people who use the data the most were like the Boys and Girls Clubs and other kinds of after school program, the YMCA. They were huge users of trying to figure out where across neighborhoods and things like that, how children were doing. But it really, and of course, we wanted to line it with CASEL, with the five SEL competencies. So each of those are assessed on it, as well as, like I said, connectedness. And the sort of the research and theories that informed the MDI, why we chose these is the whole child approach, but also having done work in the field of resiliency for decades, really trying to say at this developmental period, what are the assets that really can be the levers in children's lives? And what are those assets that are actionable? So we really chose things that like connectedness to adults at home, after school time. We know from research, there was a great article Ann Mastin and Doug Coatsworth wrote, I think 1998, and the sort of American psychologist that identified the areas of competence in this middle childhood years. So we really drew from that, but we also wanted to really draw from the sort of the research on resilience and what you can make a difference on. You can make a difference on connectedness to adults, sleep and nutrition, the peer relationship. So we really wanted it to, so people felt like, so we'd give a snapshot of how kids are doing with their thriving and things, but then you also would know how kids are doing in terms of those assets.
And so it's both theory and science based on what matters, but also picking those actionable levers that when that flashlight is there, people can act on what the flashlight sees.
Yeah, certainly. So if we think of the five dimensions of the MDIs, the social and emotional competence, connectedness with adults, connectedness with peers, after school activities, nutrition and sleep, those are the things that are assessed. And then we looked at the assets, which are like connectedness to adults at home, at school, and in the community, having good physical health, all those kinds of things. We created a well-being index because we felt like we really wanted to have something that was a composite of, so you could see what percentage of children are thriving, which ones are just doing well, which ones have low well-being. So we really thought hard about how to communicate that information. I do want to say the other thing, based on the EDI, is the EDI really focused on vulnerability. And I really came in and said, I really want a strengths-based measure. We are so much always talking about the glass half full, everything that's wrong and things. And I wanted to surface this idea of let's look at the strengths. I mean, of course, you know if they have low in the strengths, but it was really changing that narrative to really be a strengths-based focus.
Why I'm bringing Roger up again is that one of the things that Roger had pointed out to me that I learned, that is, even though I was focusing on strengths more than deficits, I would always come to my work and in my writing by saying, here are the problems and then here are the solutions. And Roger said, no, just reverse it. Start by talking about the strengths and then talk about what people are not doing rather than vice versa. And I think that mindset, just like a mindset that is focusing more on assets rather than on challenges, is very important. It's not that challenges don't matter. I think that David Hawkins has made a really important point about the fact that all because of the fact that you promote does not mean that you don't need to reduce risk. But the real issue is, what do you flashlight on the most first, and what are you really focused on? Is it the elimination of those risks of the problems, or even more important, is it the promoters of thriving?
Yeah, and it's when the thing I've learned, and because we do, and as I've told you before, to me, when we were developing the MDI in my head, we also had to be developing the dissemination plan of how we share the data. I didn't think I wasn't going to develop it and then say as an afterthought, think, oh, and then we'll figure out how to do it. I did it right parallel with this idea of having a toolkit of actually using MDI data and going and sharing. And over the years, I've really realized the most fun, the fun, I just, it's all fun. The fun part that I really loved is when we go to a school and we're in the beginning of meeting with the educators and with community members and sharing the data to number one, always start with the strengths are. Always start with, wow, this is great. Then start the sort of the not challenges and problems. To me, it's the curiosities. I'm so curious of why this is kind of lower for these kids or. And it was really in those sessions, which we called meaning-making sessions, that they had the answers, not me. They were the ones who could answer them. I have a great story I'll just tell briefly. We were working up north in British Columbia. I went and presented the MDI data, and I was presenting it to all the principals who had, let's say there were 15 different elementary schools. And I was presenting the data, and I said, this is so interesting. We were looking at its population level, and I'll explain that in a minute, but we do all the children of fourth to seventh grade. Going to some schools, and these schools had stayed pretty much the same. Their well-being index was good, but there was this group of about three or four schools that it had really decreased the well-being across the year. And I'm like, what? This is so curious to me. And the principals right away go, oh, wildfires happened in BC. The kids were all displaced. I wouldn't necessarily have known that, but they knew right away what was happening in their school.
I don't know if this has been your experience, but one of the things that I always found wonderful when we would unpack data, like the conditions for learning data, but it could be other surveys that we've done with people, either at a school level or a district level, is there's always a data story because there's always differences. It's the minute you start to disaggregate or you look over time. And then if you frame the question, and you and I actually frame in the same way, because the first thing it is, why does this group of students appear to be succeeding while another group is not, rather than vice versa? But still, there are those points of differences. And once that flashlight is there and the question is asked about why, people can use their local knowledge and their local expertise and their ability to collaborate to start problem solving it. And particularly, and I think you were doing that, if the right stakeholders are there. So if young people are there as well, if families are there, if the school nurses are there, the more you have that, the more you have that expertise.
So true. And so I just want to, I know this is probably a question people have, is it's the MDI is population level. So what that means essentially is that we go into a school and it's not just these, it's not an individual assessment tool that every child gets a score. You go into a school and all the students in fourth to seventh grade complete it. And then what we do is a report for each school, and then the entire, it's the whole district. So it isn't just some schools. It's every child in the district, 4th to 7th grade, who will take the MDI. Sometimes it's just, they depends on the year. Some say this year we'll do 4th and then we'll do 5th the next year just to follow the same group of kids. It depends. But so every child completes it. And what we give them is aggregated data back about here's the children in your school. So no way looks at children individually by classrooms. That would not be somehow because we look at things or the individual assessment. Johnny has this and Emma has that. But it's really because to me, if you really want to make change, it's at the universal. It's the idea that every child, even though there's some that might be struggling more than others, that anything you do has to be at that level of the population of children. The real action can take place that way.
Question, as someone who also does population-based instruments, we or I disaggregate them, but in a way that never gets down to Kim Schoenert. So we have exclusionary rules so that you disaggregate, but if there's a small number of people who have a particular set of categories, you can't report out at that level because then people would know who it is. But if that's,
Yes.
I'm only pulling this out because I think you disaggregate as well. Am I right? You.
Yeah, we do things that if we have less than 5 children in a school, because we have some really small rural schools up in northern British Columbia, so we don't do any way that's identifiable. We haven't to date, they're just starting now after leaving BC 5 years ago, looking at differences between boys and girls. But other than that, and because it's such a, so I would say every year, we probably have data on 40,000 to 50,000 students. So it's, if you think about almost every school district in BC has been doing the MDI. So we do disaggregate in some ways. Two points I want to make just I think are important. One is we never, the school level data are never reported publicly, but the district level data are. So we never want to have where one school is being flagged. Anyways, it's an interesting, there's been so much pushback in at least in British Columbia about school rankings and things like that. So we really, again, worked with the union very closely. The other thing I do want to mention is, again, if we're looking at resilience and looking at assets and looking at well-being, we do use passive consent, which means that we actually, because it's a measure of child well-being and assets, that we actually give parents or caregivers the option out. And so typically we have about 98% of the population covered. So it's truly a population level measure of well-being.
In survey research, one can do statistical analyses of the implications of people who are not there. Given the consents procedure, are you able to also do some analyses to try to infer what the missing data are?
Yeah, we have. It's an interesting. What's interesting, what happened again, it's always time and place. I always think back to this Glenn Elder, I think, who did lots of great work on resiliency about children and time and place. And I have to say, the MDI came at a really important time and place. It's always timing, I feel, that how things are uptake. It came at a time where there was a real pushback about rankings by academic achievement, and parents could opt out of their students, of their children taking standardized achievement test scores. We found, and over the years this has happened, that more students complete the MDI than complete the standardized achievement testing, which again is very fascinating in itself. And to answer your question, we have done some analyses, but it typically tends to be students who have chronic absenteeism and students who have real special needs where, even though we really encourage someone to sit with them to have them complete it, but it might be those students who are like that. But other than that, we really, in fact, I've had parents contact me over the years, ask me, what's this survey? What's it like? Some are, why are they asking my child all these questions? And typically, when I just explain it to them, they're just like, oh, yes, that's what we want. We've really done, and I do have to say, we've done a very good public campaign for parents to really know a lot about. And when we went to the students and we were piloting, we said, we need to know how you're doing. We need to know about your lives. And I always would joke with the little ones, the 4th grade, 5th grade. I'd be like, I could go to my office and read the books. I could ask your teachers. I could ask your parents. Some would go, you could just Google it. You could, I'm sure now they'd go chat GPT, but I'd say, how am I really going to get to know? And they'd be like, yeah, I have to ask us. I'm like, brilliant. And so we always went in there with the idea that we told them they're our teachers. They're the ones who help us help build a better world for all children. And so I do have to say, so the sort of the promotion of it and the success of it has been in some ways about our mindset, but all other times it was time and place and being able to have the right stakeholders who were supporting it.
Let me move into one key area that the MDI focuses in on, which is connectedness. And I also want to have you discuss one story that I picked up from reading your work about the Alberni story.
So I will say, so it's interesting because I didn't realize that when we jumped into the MDI that some of the largest interest and kind of controversy was in measures that we asked of how connected students were at home, at school, and the community. And we have two ways, and we actually, just so you know, the MDI, just so people know too, MDI wasn't, we created all the measures ourselves. We actually took the best measures that were out there. So the California Healthy Kids Survey are the, if you're familiar with, that's how we got the sort of the focus on adult connectedness. Dale Blythe had used this survey with, I think, Roberta Simmons in the 80s, looking at resilience and asked kids at a middle school, how many, are there any important adults at your school? Didn't define important. And then asked them just to put the initials of the important adults and found something really critical about the number of important adults you had really was related to your well-being. So we included that measure, that same one in the MDI, where we actually didn't just ask kids to say the number, we actually had them put the initials of the people. And in that, it's interesting. So then you'd find that kids, we do a whole analysis from zero, they could have up to 10, I don't know, some of them probably more. But what we found in our analysis is that the kids who had zero were lowest on well-being and all of our assets, like lowest on all the well-being indices. Those who had one were higher, doing well, but actually those students who had two or more adults as important to them were the most thriving.
Let me underscore for the audience that point. I think that there is consistent data that people hear about the importance of having one person. I think if we're really concerned with thriving, not just doing well, and if we look more deeply at our data and we look at our experiences, it is rarely one person. It's not that one person can't do it, but it is most often when there are multiple people.
Yeah, and I always feel like it's you have one and a spare. It's almost like you have might be your classroom teacher, but you have the school counselor, or you have. I loved it. My favorite was when we asked kids, they were like, this person is so important to me. I'm not sure what they do at my school, but they're really important. So it is that there's just something, it was a surprise to us, actually.
I think there is a difference from people feeling that they are in a place where someone has their back and being in a place where the people have their back.
Yeah, I think that's a great assessment. So I'll tell you what happened at Alberni. The very wise superintendent who knew quite well, he got his MDI data for his seventh graders. They had just done the seventh graders, and they started looking at their results about number of important adults. And just so you know, we put it in this really cool way, and a lot of schools look at it. And I do have to say, I've talked to some principals who are like, I'm not going to share that with my teachers. It'll just depress them. There is a thing, or they don't believe it. They think, oh, kids just thought who was important, like an important person. It's interesting how they try and interpret it, but actually, this has been tried and true. We validated. I do have to say that. So, what happened to Alberni is they got their data in 2013, and 53% of seventh graders, more than half, said they had no important adult at school. 50, more than half of the seventh graders said, there's no one here. Of course, they showed it to the educators and the super, and they're all like, oh my, their first reaction was like, oh, what happened? We think we make a meaningful thing for these kids every day, and they don't think we're important. So first you have to get over being heartbroken that you're not, and you have to move on. Okay, no matter what we're doing, the kids aren't doing it. So they decided to come together at the beginning of the school year and do two things. One is to make a list of all the things they can do to be connecting to students. Say hi to them in the hallway. Some of the things I say is kids tell us, say hi to me in the hallway by my name. But they decided to even make a list of kids who were not, actually, there's a great Edutopia video on this, who didn't seem to have anyone who really knew that well about them. But they put this effort into full on, full court press. I use a basketball metaphor in memory of Roger to do, let's connect with kids. Let's put that as our focus of connecting with every single student. And not just those students who get in trouble, because they have lots of adults, but those kids who, how did someone describe it to me once, who sit by themselves reading a book during lunchtime, who are those kids who could be easily invisible. So they did that full on for that year, and the next year they got their MDI data and they went from 53% to 30%, and they doubled the amount of kids who had two important adults. So they just reversed the entire thing from zero to two or more just by saying we're going to intentionally focus to connect to our kids.
You know that when I started to do work in Chicago and they brought me in for high school reform, in the first consultation, and this is before I even raised the notion of doing a population level survey, because I didn't think they were going to ask for that, and that they'd invite it. They asked me a question. They said, if you were coming to Chicago and you were going to be a principal in a school for 1 year, what would you do? And I said, do you really mean only 1 year? Because that's not enough time to transform a school. And they said, yes, only 1 year. Then I said, what I would do would be I would sit down with my staff and we would develop a strategy so that every student in that school had at least one adult who they felt close to and who they felt had their backs. And they said, why would you do that? And I said, because if you start to do that is the path towards transformation, both because of what it means to students, but also what it starts to mean for teachers when they are interacting with students in a different way and learning from them.
I love that. That's so amazing. And it's interesting, and I'll give this to you. I don't know if anybody else on your podcast had talked about this, because I think a lot of teachers, it's interesting, this connectedness. I keep on saying that's really what matters. And then the learning happens afterward. Then they can trust you. Then there's so many things that's so foundational. But I tell people about this 2x10 strategy. I don't know if you've heard about this. You probably have. 2 minutes a day, take your most, I always say, I know they say challenging student. I say take your most annoying student, because everybody will admit there's those students who are a bit annoying. And take the opportunities for 2 minutes a day for 10 days in a row to have a positive conversation with them. Usually I say, that student, you're saying, stop talking, don't sit in your chair like that, pick up the wrapper from this floor. It's all those things we say to them. And just go and say, do they have new shoes on? Do they have a new haircut? Do they? And I said, at first, the student will look at you like you're kind of crazy, because they're like, you never say anything nice to me. But if you consistently do it, it's so interesting. So many teachers have said that 2x10 has transformed them and their relationships. And so what's important about the MDI, to just go back to that, is that question about important adults really surfaced so many conversations about how do we become important to our students.
Let me now move into another area that the MDI covers and that you have written about as well, which is after school time as an ecological asset for young people. I think one of the things that really distinguishes the MDI is it pays an unusual amount of attention. It unusual only because people are not doing it. Not unusual because of the fact that it's not the right thing to do to how children spend their time between 3 and 6 p.m. Treating that window not as empty space, but as a developmental asset, or depending on what young people are doing, as a developmental risk site. What do the MDI data reveal if you're looking across the data you've been collecting about the role of out-of-school participation in community?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And really, the MDI started with the focus on that, I have to say, because it was first this United Way study on after school time is how it began. And then it morphed into the MDI was because people didn't know anything about what kids were doing after school. And that's what the study we called it. What do kids do when they're not in school? And we focused on the 3 to 6. I do have to say those hours are really unstructured time. It's the time the school ends, but the workday doesn't end. So a lot of kids are left on their own. I think I read data from California, where there are more emergency hospital room visits for kids at that time between 3 and 6, and also delinquency. The kids, what's again, is that maybe undeveloped prefrontal cortex when you're with a whole bunch of kids who make poor decisions sometimes. And so we really wanted to focus on the after school time. And we looked at both structured activities and unstructured activities. So the idea of after school sports, but music lessons and community centers, but also what they were doing. Were they volunteering? Were they at home on their devices? The one thing we did that was so unique, I have to say, I'm very proud. It's probably one of the things I'm most proud about for the MDI that really had such a catalyst is we not only asked them what they do, we had an open-ended question to say, what do you wish to be doing? And we were able to use those data to report back to community agencies that helped develop new programming for kids based on what the kid, like, how novel is that? Ask the kids what they want to be doing. And so we showed in the research, and we have several papers on this, is that those students who are involved in structured after school activities had many more benefits. The last point I want to make, and this we haven't talked about, so because the MDI is a population level and at the brilliance of Clyde Hertzman, an epidemiologist, the MDI data are presented through GIS mapping by neighborhood. So you can actually look an entire school district by neighborhood and determine what percentage of kids are in structured after school time. That was again a catalyst when school districts got their data back and saw huge inequities in terms of opportunities for after school time across the district. And then one district, Burnaby, actually worked in a matter of 3 years, was able to really not see the huge inequities and then go and work intentionally more with community agencies connected to school. And just by the end of 3 years, basically, you saw the entire school district where every child was being involved in after school activities.
There's a river. There's a